This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
No doubt you've heard people living in dense cities use less energy and create fewer emissions. Since national governments are doing practically nothing to confront climate change, cities are trying to lower their carbon footprints. But is the whole concept of densification working? And the answer to that question leads to deeper matters. How can we live with less, doing less damage, and still be who we are? We're fortunate to get some insight from our next guest. Daniel M. Kamen is a heavyweight in energy research. He's advised everyone from the World Bank to the American government. Daniel is a member of the National Academy of Science and played a leading role in two reports for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Right now, he's a professor of energy at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory. Dr. Kamen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Now, you have a brand new paper out. I want to read out the title. It is Spatial Distribution of U.S. Household Carbon Footprints Reveals Suburbanization Undermines Greenhouse Gas Benefits of Urban Population Density. Now, Daniel, what caused you to look into the greenhouse gas footprints for American households?
Well, there's really two different motivations for this work. The first is that places like British Columbia and California, New England, have climate carbon policies in place. And we're all very aware of the carbon that we emit because of our electricity consumption, whether we're in a high-carbon coal-burning area or a place with hydropower, solar, wind, whatever else. And we're getting more and more attention to the greenhouse gas emissions from our vehicles. But the third part of that story is really the carbon that's embedded in the goods and services we consume, food, perishables, durables. And so we wanted to put all of those things, energy for our homes, transportation, and then the rest of the things all into a sort of easy-to-find big data format so we can really examine the details. We need that because if we're going to bring our greenhouse gas emissions down dramatically, we really need to understand all of the sources. And so that was the first side of the motivator. It's kind of the immediate data to support policy part of the equation. But the second piece is actually something that I've been interested in for a long time, and it's more theoretical, and that is, there's been centuries of debate about what are the optimal sizes of cities. And we've seen mega cities grow around the world with Mexico City and Tokyo and others with more than 20 or 30 million people. And by almost everyone's agreement, certainly mine, those are not really easily livable locations. And yet we all can't live in tiny hamlets of two or three homes dotted across the countryside. So there seems like there are some optimal sizes in between those extremes. And one of the metrics that's going to have to become central to our thinking as we go forward is global sustainability. So this is the first effort from my lab to build a comprehensive, in this case, a national U.S. data set to start to look at those equations in ways that we hope to do for Canada, for Europe, for China as well, to really understand what's that rural-urban-suburban relationship.
So one of the key concepts in this paper is the household carbon footprint, or HCF. How can you calculate something like that?
So we do it two different ways. There's an earlier paper we published in the same journal in 2011 where we had posted online a carbon footprint calculator, and anybody can go on it. The website is coolclimate.berkeley.edu. And you can simply use it to calculate your carbon footprint. You say how many cars you have, what type of car, put in your utility bill, are you a vegan, do you commute to work by bus, by car, whatever else. You put all the basic features in, and it will compute it for you. And so we gathered data that was provided by people across the country voluntarily about their energy use. And we've used that, and then we've used national level data on household income, energy consumption, types of vehicles to build up the rest of the story. So we have both scattered data from around the country for individuals, for households, and then we have metadata that we use to put together what you see in the paper, and that is the greenhouse gas emissions per household averaged over a U.S. postal code.
So we're just focusing on households, though. We're not talking about industrial emissions or the footprint of the government or the military?
That's right. This is purely the carbon associated with the consumption of individual homes. Now, it does it does affect or it does reflect industry in the sense of if I buy anything from strawberries that are locally grown or imported from Chile or a vehicle produced in California or in China, it does reflect the carbon associated with that, but it is about consumption at the household level. It's not an economy-wide picture.
Let's talk about the maps you developed for this paper. I think my listeners would like to look them over because I haven't seen anything quite like them before. What did you map out?
So what we plotted was the average greenhouse gas emissions per household per postal code. And when you go to coolclimate.berkeley.edu/maps, you will see the aggregate map that includes transportation, energy use in homes, goods, services, and food, the five kind of key categories. And we have 37 subcategories that are aggregated into those. But then you also see each of the individual maps, the map for transportation, the map for homes, the maps for goods, food, services. So you can look at the pieces individually. And as you run your cursor across the map, the data is dynamic. It will show you what the emissions are. And again, each postal code, it's an average value across that area. So obviously there's individuals that are higher or lower. You can use the tool I mentioned, CoolClimateBerkeley.edu, to calculate your own and compare what are you like compared to your neighbors. And of course, in rural areas, there's a lot of averaging because the density is very low of people and we have quite a large amount of difference. So it's a useful indicator in rural areas, but it's not particularly meaningful. But U.S. postal codes, zip codes, are quite fine-grained in suburban areas and cities, and so you get a really high-resolution view in urban areas. And if you zoom in, you can see individual things. If you zoom in on New York City, you can see there's no emissions associated with Central Park. In San Francisco, you can see Golden Gate Park because there's no people living there, and so we really get a very fine-grained view. And you start to see, if you will, an image of our infrastructure. For people who live right along light rail or mass transit lines, you can see lower emissions from transportation. For people who are walking distance to, whether it's the Washington, D.C. Metro, the San Francisco BART, whatever the mass transit system is. And so you start to see the veins of our infrastructure in those urban footprints.
Daniel Kamen, we all like to blame someone else for changing the climate. It's the oil companies or a cabal of billionaires. But really, your study found common people living in the suburbs account for around half of all U.S. household emissions. Why the suburbs?
Well, Toto was right. We found the enemy, and it is us, in the sense of if you're a urban dweller in a dense urban area with a lot of public transportation, your footprint is lower than if you're a suburban dweller. And it's not just being near mass transit. There's a whole range of things associated with suburbs that tend to be higher emissions. Homes are larger, so there's more energy consumption, and there is a affluence and energy consumption association. Delivering packages and goods and services to suburbanites takes more energy. So there's a whole variety of things. It's not just our driving. But the footprint of suburban life is higher than the footprint of urban life is, controlling for all of the factors, just because distances are spread out and there's more things you need to go and get or have delivered to you.
Okay, now if we looked at the overall global greenhouse gas emissions, how important are American households in that picture?
So there's a couple ways to look at it. Americans and Canadians are the highest emitters per capita in the world. Until recently, the United States was the largest net greenhouse gas emitter. China has now overtaken the U.S., and of course, emissions per Chinese are quite low. There happen to be a lot more Chinese than U.S. citizens. And much more of China's emissions are industrial than in the U.S. So U.S. suburban, well, U.S. overall household, but suburban emissions in particular, are really quite important for a couple reasons. One, they're a significant chunk of U.S. emissions in the United States is just about a quarter of global emissions. So U.S. and China together are about half of the overall story. But the other reason why it's really important is because the patterns of consumption that we see from U.S. and Canada are in many ways the model, good or bad, that people aspire to around the world. And because of that, changes in consumption patterns, if everyone in parts of North America decide they have to have the next big screen TV or this or that, then the energy to make that, the energy to run it all, not only we rack it up in our tallies here, but that's often a big driver for kind of conspicuous consumption elsewhere around the world, people emulating that model. So U.S. household emissions are important twice over.
Really? That did scare me when I saw that people in China were buying up big Buicks in a big way, and they're working on the American model. But we're talking about the suburbs. The American suburb seems designed like a carbon-burning machine right now. You have to drive to schools to get food, even further to work. But it's built now, Daniel. What can we do about that?
Well, that, I think that's where the story gets really interesting, because this paper does not say, oh, suburbs are bad and urban cores are good. And that would be far too simplistic a message. What it says is that choices we're going to make about infrastructure in the future and choices we're making now have a big effect. So, for example, we look at a city like Portland, Oregon, that spent quite a bit of thought in looking at how can they design well-functioning mass transit, not only downtown, but light rail lines that snake out through the suburban areas, so that you don't need to drive a couple miles, leave your car at the light rail stop, and then take the rail in. It's really quite a thoughtful network that connects parts of town so that you can get back and forth in ways where you don't need to drive. So Portland's decisions have made it a low-carbon leader, and in fact, Portland has the lowest vehicle ownership per capita of any large U.S. city. We have other examples around the country that have done very thoughtful things as well, but one of the features is that cities have become leaders in low-carbon policies. New York City, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago in the U.S., Vancouver in Canada have all become very, very important leaders in finding ways to recycle urban waste into energy and to use the waste heat from industrial facilities for local heating. There's all kinds of really clever ideas that are being put into practice. That's really important, but many of those cities don't include the suburbs in their plan because often the municipal government is really an urban government, the downtown core. And so they've really done what they can to make the area for which they have jurisdiction as clean as possible. But as you say, we do have these huge suburban sprawls around our cities, and it's unfair, it's unrealistic to look at New York or San Francisco or Vancouver and only look at the core and not think about what it means in terms of not just commuting, but moving goods and services around for that very important and very vital and very distributed suburbia. And so that's really the lesson, that yes, we've made a lot of choices in the past that do not reflect best sustainability practices. We acknowledge that. But the real solution going forward is we need to be holistic. And so I'm really excited about a particular piece of what's going on in California. And that is, like British Columbia, we have a carbon price. We have a cap and trade system. And the bill that puts that in place, Assembly Bill 32, says we need to cut our emissions, and we have strategies for 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050. But there's an associated bill that gets a lot less attention, but is probably even more important in the long run. It's Senate Bill 375. And 375 is a land use bill, and it says something very interesting. It says that decisions about urban and suburban sprawl and land use need to reflect the greenhouse gas targets. And that's a little bit hard to define, but what it says is every time that a new housing development or a mall or a freeway is authorized, the greenhouse gas implications of that have to be considered, and because California's plan is to get back down to our 1990 baseline in 2020, be about a 20% cut from where we are today, and by 2050 to be 80% below that, so it's a really just dramatic drop in overall emissions, that land use decisions must reflect that plan. And that, to my mind, is a really beautiful synergy between the aspirational greenhouse gas target and an operational tool helping to guide cities to use things like our coolclimate.berkeley.edu calculator to figure out if we are going to build a new suburb, for example, what do we do to make sure the light rail goes there and to make sure that there's enough services and amenities so people don't need to drive downtown to get the same type of restaurant or to have a place where you can pick up your packages and parcels. And all of those decisions go into really minimizing that footprint.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with energy and climate scientist Daniel M. Kamen from the University of California, Berkeley. We've been talking a little bit hopeful, and I have a two-part question for you. Reading your energy blog in National Geographic, I see you attend many of the power conferences around the world, from Abu Dhabi to London. First off, do you think leaders in large institutions and corporations, do they realize we're on the brink of a climate catastrophe? Are the people at the top getting the message?
Oh, that's a hard one. I think that people hear the message. I think there are some people who certainly get it. I would argue that, well, we haven't done as much as we'd like. President Obama has definitely said and has tried to act on some of the right things. He gave a critically important climate speech during the summer saying that we were going to use the current boom in natural gas, not just to transition from coal to gas, but to pivot to a new future. Chancellor Merkel in Germany has been a leader on this for years in terms of really making change. Japan has been a critical leader. Korea absolutely ramped up from really a non-player to a global leader in sustainable practices involving transportation and wind. So I think that some leaders hear it very clearly, and I think that everyone sees it. But what this paper was really designed to do was to fill in what I feel is the, one of the big problems, and that is that almost everyone, there's a few holdouts admittedly, see this as the transition we have to make. But many people feel unempowered. They either don't know the information or feel that what they do individually won't matter. The standard line in the U.S. In political debates in Washington, D.C. is often, well, we were the biggest emitter, but now it's China. So we'll just simply wait for them to act. And that obviously doesn't get anything done. So what we did in this project was not only to try to make the data really clear and visible to people, and that's why we have these interactive maps online, but the calculator tool I mentioned in the beginning is one where you can not only go in and do your carbon audit and then compare your home to the neighbors, but after you finish doing the audit, the last button you click is the, what we call the take action page. And after we have your carbon budget in the computer, it will then show you, here are the actions that you have not yet taken that would have the biggest impact. And whether it's getting a more efficient vehicle or signing up for a carpool system or using new apps that are available so you can so-called trip chain. And that means that when you go shopping, you have an app on your phone, for example, that shows you, oh, you need eggs, but you also need to stop at the hardware store. And it turns out that this grocery store is right next to this hardware store. Why don't you do them together? And trip chaining is one way to not only save on carbon, but what we're seeing is that, of course, it saves you on time. And so often the global benefit is the one that made us do the analytic work, but the better quality of life by spending less time commuting around is the immediate motivator. And so this whole project is about providing that information to individuals, to corporations, to municipal leaders, so that they can really take charge of this. And again, I don't think that this kind of sustainability path is one where it needs to be difficult. In fact, most of the things that we find save on carbon emissions, save on water consumption, reduce air quality problems, also improve your quality of life. And that's what this is really all about.
Another interesting thing I found in the paper is that you're recommending different regional approaches rather than a one-size-fits-all greenhouse plan. Can you talk to us about that, Daniel Kamen?
Yeah, so that's kind of a challenge. Certainly at one level, whether it's state or province or regional or national, having a greenhouse gas plan in place saying we're committed to reducing emissions, we're committed to putting a price on emissions is a critical meta part of the story. But then the details really vary. What this project shows is that the emissions, the greenhouse gas footprint, if you will, of households in California is dominated by transportation because our electricity is already quite clean, as is the case in British Columbia, where you're largely hydropower supported. In the Midwest of the United States, that's not true. Driving distances per household are a little bit less on average, and emissions from electricity for homes is much higher because there's much more coal being burned there. So the strategies need to vary. And the cities that really want to become leaders in this, or the states, or the governors, or the environmental groups, really need to reflect those differences. And so my hope is that this really empowers people to find ways to act that address their local issues, not to feel like a cookie-cutter solution designed in Washington, D.C. or Ottawa or Sacramento or Albany have to be the strategy everyone uses. That's not the case. And this is a really disaggregated picture, zip code by zip code, to understand those differences.
Okay, we've been talking with Daniel Kamen. He's written 12 books, hundreds of scientific papers, and advised governments on energy policy. Daniel is the director of Energy Research Group at the University of California, Berkeley. You can find links to more information about this study on U.S. household carbon footprints in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. Daniel Kamen, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock, and I hope you'll be back again.
I'd be delighted to. Thank you so much for having me on.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.